Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 156, recorded June 7th, 2014. Charles Platt, Make Electronics. Triangulation is brought to you by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts, no monthly fees. For 10% off any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT10 at checkout. And by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like whole wheat apple pie figgy bars. Oh, baby! To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TRIANGULATION to receive $10 off at checkout. Welcome to Triangulation, the show where we get the most interesting people in technology and on the internet to join us for an hour and talk a little bit about what they're up to. And I think our guest, Charles Platt, today is really one of the most interesting people we've talked to, partly because of his multivariate career. Currently, a contributing editor at Make Magazine, and he's done two really great books for people who want to learn about electronics, Make Electronics and the Encyclopedia of Electronic Components, a really, really nice books that give you step-by-step instructions in the Make tradition on how to get into, you know, all the key critical stuff of making your own circuitry. But Mr. Platt, also a science fiction author, early writer for Wired magazine, and I'm really glad to welcome Charles Platt. Oh, and the nephew of the Baron of Grindelford. Really lovely to welcome.
Yeah, leave the most important part to last, absolutely.
Do you get a castle with that, anything?
Unfortunately, it's not inherited. I would have to, in fact, I could be Sir Charles Platt, but I think I would have to kill about 53 people to get that.
late in the line of succession is not good. Yeah. Well, anyway, Charles, no. Welcome to TWiT and to Triangulation. It's really great to get mm-hmm. you on. You've actually had such an interesting career, always, I guess, as a writer, but about a variety of topics. And in fact, I think a lot of people watching might have heard of your book and even read The Silicon Man. Which is kind of timely today, talks about pouring your brain into a machine and cyberspace and in the way we understand it today. You stopped mm-hmm. writing sci-fi, though. Why'd you give it up?
I stopped writing science fiction around 1990 because I became a journalist for Wired magazine, yeah. And it was more exciting to me to be able to write about things that were actually going to happen rather than just to speculate on what I hoped would happen.
Yeah, especially with Wired in the earliest days where you really were kind of at ringside seats at the revolution, covering the beginnings of something amazing.
It got to the point where people would be reading Wired because they felt that they might miss out on something
right.
if they didn't read Wired. It was all kind of based on fear of being left behind. And then eventually people, I think, figured out that they weren't going to be left behind. So some of the tension of the magazine diminished as time went by.
You nailed it, and that's exactly why I read Wired, among other things. I was already covering technology, writing for other magazines, but it was so, there was in those days this feeling that things are moving very quickly, and it was very easy to lose track of what's going on. You really did feel this kind of urgency. How is it that we've become complacent? Because things haven't slowed down.
There was a hiatus. I mean, the dot-com bubble did burst.
Yeah.
And then we unfortunately had the tragedy of 9/11, at which point I think people stopped looking forward to the future and became somewhat more afraid of the future.
Wow, how interesting. I think you're right, actually. There was
which was a very sad experience for me because I've always been very optimistic about the future, and I just never imagined that this terrorist act with these guys on a couple of planes could have that much effect.
And obviously did. You've written software. You are, I presume, still an expert, although it's not as exciting a field as it might have been in cellular automata. I find that fascinating, going back to Marvin Gardner's Scientific American articles about life, the game of life, Conway's life.
Right.
Is that still a thing?
No one can really figure out what to use it for. At least that was the last I knew about it. I went to the first conference on cellular automata at MIT, and I brought with me a little program that I'd written myself, which was like a user-friendly version of cellular automata. But it was compelling as an example of how you can create very complicated patterns from very simple rules. And it looks like an analog of what happens with the human genome, where you have something which you actually could store on a CD-ROM, but it has the instructions for creating a person.
Right.
And, okay, so we all agreed that that's how it looked. But then what do you actually do with these cellular automata? There was some application for behavior of traffic on highways, some application to fluid dynamics, but I kind of lost interest when it got like that.
Yeah. It was like many areas of computer science, it became kind of a dead end. I guess artificial intelligence, another dead end, although that's resurfaced, as we've learned on recent episodes. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the maker movement, because in some ways this is the rebirth of the joy, the sheer joy in technology. But instead of just software, now it's physical stuff too.
There have been three phases, I think. The first phase occurred when I was very young, and that was building your own hi-fi equipment, your own preamplifier and amplifier using vacuum tubes. And I went through that, and then I went on to other things. And then in the 1970s, we had the excitement of being able to buy our own silicon chips, which was a surprise. And then we read Don Lancaster's TTL cookbook, and yes, he showed us that we could actually do things with these chips.
Classic.
And now we have the kind of third wave, which I think was started by Dale Doherty, really, with Make Magazine.
Dale is a personal hero of mine and just one of the sweetest guys ever. You actually have a picture in the Make Electronics book of the TTL a weather-beaten TTL cookbook. So obviously, you might have done a little bit with this in your day.
I went through the whole thing.
The whole thing is like 2,000 pages or something. No, oh no. This is a 2,000-page catalog. Below it is a 2,000-page catalog from the Mouser Electronics Supply Catalog.
You know, there is actually another book, which I guess you don't have. It's called Make More Electronics. So sequel to Make Electronics is now on Amazon. It's been published and just takes you another step farther into complications.
We're going to have more with Charles Platt and his electronics books and talk about the Make movement in a second. But first, I want to talk about how you can do something at home that doesn't involve hammering, drilling, screwing, but in fact can really make a big difference in your house. A brand new sponsor we want to welcome, SmartThings, to the TWiT network. This is the key to the whole SmartThings setup. This is your SmartThings hub. You hook this up, you plug it in, and then you add the sensors, switches, and outlets, and you can automate your home very affordably, very easy. SmartThings has done the key thing that I've said for a long time. It bridges a variety of different APIs and standards, because that's the problem with home automation, as you probably know if you've tried to do it. But you only need one SmartThings to talk to them all. SmartThings not only supports a variety of manufacturers like GE and Schlage and Honeywell. Schlage, that's cool. That's the lock that automatically opens. So you can actually have the little SmartThings sensor in your glove compartment when you pull up, and the door will unlock. Things like that. Also works with your smartphone, of course. Honeywell, Eon. But it also works with Nest. I mean, it's really sophisticated. The Philips Hue, which you know I love those lights. Imagine you pull up, the lights go down. The doors open. The automatic martini maker. They don't have that yet, but when they do, Wemo, it works with Sonos. So you can play a nice song. Come on, when you pull up. The smart home security kit is $329. That includes the hub, a smart sense motion sensor, a smart sense presence sensor. That's really a multi-purpose thing that can do all sorts of stuff. The smart sense, actually you get three smart sense multi-sensors. So that could be for doors, windows, drawers, senses when things open and close, can measure temperature and acceleration and vibration. That is cool. What can we do with vibration when the dryer starts? it'll start vibrating. That is so cool. This is magnet. Oh, so that's so you can use it for a window. This is a two-part thing. This is really cool. And it's so easy to set up. You just pull this out and you pair it and you're good. You're golden. The smarter home security kit, $479, adds another motion sensor and a smart power outlet and the siren strobe alarm. The smartest home security kit for $599 includes all the above and another presence sensor, another power outlet, and another outdoor light plug and control. You can imagine what you could do. I mean, mix and match. And I love it that it works with everything else. This is a really smart thing. I've been looking for this, in fact, for a long time, and I was thrilled when SmartThings came out with these devices. You can get 10% off any of those home security kits if you use the offer code TWIT10 when you check out. So do that right now. Go to smartthings.com/twit. Learn more. Use our offer code TWIT10 on checkout for 10% off any of those home security kits. Much more than just home security. You can really automate your home. I've been setting it up. It's really fun and very easy to use. I really like it. smartthings.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT10. And now back to triangulation with Charles Platt.
What I like about this, some of the make stuff is you know, trebuchets, is very physical stuff. And I'm really interested in electronics. I think that to me, digital technology first and then electronics second is something that greatly interests me. What age, first of all, what age should we start doing this with our kids? How old is old enough?
That's a very difficult question. It depends on the child, obviously, but I would... If someone has the interest, I would feel happy about them doing it when they're like 7 or 8, okay. Maybe. I mean, all the voltages are low. The only hazard I can think of is people swallowing the components.
Well, a 3-year-old, no.
To swallow them, I think they
we don't want any children eating resistors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we haven't
had that happen yet.
No, so I think it's okay. And the soldering iron is probably the single most dangerous thing in this whole process.
Yeah, but you only make that mistake once.
Yes.
When the soldering iron falls and you think, oh my goodness, it's going to burn the carpet, and you catch it, you don't do that more than once.
Yeah, you don't catch it twice, yeah. So this, I think this would be a great thing to get going with kids. Of course, there's a lot of, you know, kits now and that you can buy that they snap together and stuff. This is the real deal. This is like real electronics, which I think is fun.
Well, the alternative, which is the way things are going, is to have a microcontroller such as an Arduino,
right,
and go online and find a program that somebody else wrote and download it in and press a button and you get a result. But that means you don't really know what's going on. And the only way to get a thorough understanding is to go back to the actual components, the chips and the transistors and the resistors and the capacitors. So my book seems to be the only book which is sort of hardcore in that respect.
Yeah, I like it. It really is. I mean, you launch right into it, which is great. And by the way, the subtitle, Learning by Discovery, is absolutely key to this whole thing. You got to do it to find out what happens. And if you switch a resistor, you'll know.
Well, when I was at school, and I think even now when most people are at school, you often start with a theory, like
right.
Ohm's law.
Right.
And then you make a couple of deductions. And then finally, if you're lucky, you get a chance to build something. But I prefer to say, take these components, put them together, and what do you see?
Right.
And what can we learn from that? And eventually we derive the theory. So it's the other way around. And this is actually the way science is done in the real world. Very often someone will see something and that's odd. How can we explain this? And eventually you have a process of discovery.
By page 32, we're already making a battery. You get right into it. We're making switches by the second chapter, relays, and all sorts of fun things in here. And the more electronics, you're doing more logic and stuff like that, or?
Make more electronics was satisfying two requirements. First of all, there were some things that I left out of the original Make Electronics book. And so I thought I'd better put them in, such as amplification and audio amplification, for instance. And then I went farther into things like digital chips, because you can learn so much about how computers work
right.
if you are assembling those little AND and OR and XOR gates on your own breadboard.
Does the one follow the other, or can you pick up more electronics and start there?
I assume that before someone is going to read Make More Electronics, they have read some introductory book, okay. whether it's mine or someone else's, so that they know what a resistor is and what a capacitor does. And that's the level which I assume they start with. Very, very basic.
Can you still buy all these components? I mean, Radio Shack doesn't have the bins of resistors it used to have.
Actually, just about every Radio Shack store has some bins. Some of them have more than others. But the way I think it makes sense to do it is to buy online.
Yeah.
And the way the new book suggests you do that is I break it down. These are the components you need for one experiment. These are the components you need for the first third of the book. Or these are the components you need for the whole book, and it's up to you how many you buy.
You could create a shopping basket. Go to go to Adafruit or somewhere. We've had Lady Ada on. I mean, she's done such a great job of popularizing this.
Yeah, I love that site.
It so excites me that there is so much of this. It feels to me almost a renaissance. It says on the back of the book that you started your journey at the age of 15 making an answering machine. Telephone answering machines didn't even exist back then.
You had to rent one from the phone company for some ridiculous amount of money. And you were not allowed to connect your own answering machine to the telephone network. So I was started off right from the start as a lawbreaker. What can I say?
Well, it's fun that you've come full circle and you're teaching people how to do this themselves now, which is really great. We're going to take a break. We're talking to Charles Platt. His new book is called Make More Electronics, the sequel to Make Electronics. And don't forget, as long as we're talking the Encyclopedia of Electronic Components, you need to know that, too. And they're all available directly from Make Magazine, but also on Amazon and other places. We'll have more with Charles. Snack time! Before we get back to Charles Platt, it's time to talk about Nature Box. This is so great. These snacks delivered right to your door every month. They're three different sizes and a huge variety of snacks. But these are not just any snacks. These are nutritionist-approved snacks. They're delicious. No HFCs, no trans fats, no artificial flavor, color. Just good, wholesome stuff that tastes better than you could even imagine. Poppy seed sticks, peppery pistachios. There's over 100 snacks there. You can even tailor your Nature Box for your dietary needs. Gluten conscious, vegan, soy free, lactose free, nut free. You get non-GMO. You get your choice. You will be blown away. Now, my suggestion is just go there and get an assortment so you can try them. But if you want to narrow it down, you can. We need a guinea pig. Too bad there's not a hungry college student around here that... Henry, come here. My son. He's never tried these. Come on, run behind me. I'm going to let you choose one, Henry, and you're going to give us your unbiased opinion, okay? Lone Star Snack Mix. You like spicy maple habanero pretzel pops?
Yeah.
Yeah. Duck down a little bit. Try those. Open those up. These are all resealable. See this, and if you like this, I'll have this sent to your dorm room. This would be a great snack, a great gift for a college student. Henry lives mostly on wings.
I agree. Hot Pockets and Totino's Pizza
Rolls. Hot Pockets, Totino's Pizza Rolls, and wings. Yes, they have a dining hall. Well, what do you think?
It's good.
You like it?
Yeah, it's good.
Would you like this delivered once a month to your dorm room?
Yeah, I would.
Wouldn't that be awesome? Uh-huh. You could share it with your roommate. Nature Snack. It's kind of an interesting mix with the maple and the hot.
It's sweet and spicy.
Sweet and spicy. Here, you keep it.
Cool.
Yeah. NatureBox.com. There you go. An unsolicited testimonial. Have I ever met you before? Oh, yeah, you're my son. Cool. NatureBox.com/twit. Get 50% off your first box. That is, I'm burning up here. He likes it hot like that.
Try the other one.
You think? No. He wants to open them all now. NatureBox.com/twit. Pick your box. Get 50% off your first box when you use our offer code TWIT. I got to tell you, these are delicious. NatureBox.com/twit. And they're good for you. See? More with Charles Platt as we continue with Triangulation. Charles Platt is our guest. He is the author of a new book called Make More Electronics. He's a contributing editor at Make, longtime senior writer for Wired Magazine. He says you did 30 feature stories at Wired Magazine. What was your favorite?
Or that's one a of very hard question because yeah. They gave me so much freedom in those days. To really, I could write whatever came into my head because I had such, I kind of was in sync with the magazine. But the first thing I did for them involved going to Nassau in the Bahamas and tracking down these satellite video pirates. They were hackers making their own boards so that people could steal TV signals back in those days. And so that was an exciting adventure. They were in the Bahamas because it wasn't illegal for them to do what they were doing there in those days. But they were forever afraid of some law enforcement guy coming in from the United States and slapping handcuffs on them and dragging them off for prosecution in the United States. And they were afraid I might be one of those guys. So that was a good introduction to being a journalist.
I remember when we were at Tech TV, that was where the Bahamas and the Caribbean in general were where all of the pirate stations where we'd get callers from Trinidad and Tobago. We'd say, we're not on there. It's, oh, well, you know, we can pick up the signal. I think we never minded. The more viewers, the better. We always liked it. Let me ask about your work at Alcor. Alcor was quite notorious in the, I guess, the 90s. It was the company that was best known for preserving Ted Williams' body after he died. Froze Ted Williams' body. You were director and general manager of suspended animation in Florida. Are you gonna cut your head off and freeze it after you pass?
I'm not so sure that I'm still enthusiastic about cryonics. I was involved in it originally as a kind of strange hobby because I'd grown up reading science fiction, and the world never advanced as quickly as I had expected. You know, I expected to be living on the moon with telepathic powers, and I was still stuck in an apartment in New York City.
So frustrating.
Yeah, very frustrating. Yeah. And I thought, well, cryonics seems like interesting. And so I got mixed up in that for about 10 years.
Was it the problem that it didn't work? I guess we still don't know, do we?
Very true. The problem with cryonics is you can prove all sorts of things very convincingly in a laboratory setting where every variable is under your control. But when you're trying to do an actual case and you're out in the field and you're dealing with people in a hospital who may be hostile and relatives who are convinced it's just a scam and you're trying to get the guy's money, and there are so many things that can go wrong with a case, it's very hard to make it all come out right.
Yeah. Are there still frozen bodies somewhere?
Definitely.
Wow.
Any other questions?
Is Ted Williams floating around somewhere in the...
Oh, he's, to the best of my knowledge, he's in there. I was the staff photographer on that case.
Wow. But we have
I've never heard of him. I said, who's Ted Williams? So that
not,
was level
not a
nine.
Baseball fan, I guess.
No, I never got into baseball.
Had he been a cricket player, maybe. So
maybe not.
Maybe not. So we're going to have to solve this, though, if we're going to do long space flights, if we're going to ever kind of leave the solar system, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now, there are people around who have had hypothermic surgery in which the heart and the brain are basically flatlined for up to half an hour Like if you have an aneurysm which needs to be operated on, you cannot have any blood pressure while that is in process. So they reduce the temperature of the body, and by all conventional circumstances, you're no longer alive, but then they wake you up at the end of it.
Wow.
Now, half an hour is about the limit on that, but you can see a general principle there that if you lower the temperature without causing damage, you can hold everything in place, and you may hope that it will resume operation spontaneously when circulation is restored.
Yeah, I guess the premise for Alcor and others were, well, we don't know how to restore people now.
That's right.
Maybe in the future they can get over all the damage that's caused by the freezing and resuscitating.
It's a leap of faith. My friends don't like me using the word faith, but I see it that way.
Of course it is. Unless you saw Woody Allen's Sleeper, and then and you know it's real. Of course, they were also making a clone of the leader from his nose. That's another story entirely. I find it fascinating. People don't talk about it much anymore, and maybe even some of the younger members of our audience don't remember this idea. But the idea was, you freeze yourself. And Woody was wrapped in tinfoil, as I remember, when they brought him back. It was a little goofy for a while.
It may actually be that cryonics is one of those 60s ideas which is never going to quite resonate again the way it did back then.
Yeah, we were talking about your work as a science fiction author. That's one of the fun things about science fiction, though, is you get to think about stuff like this and then kind of think of what the outcomes would be. Do you feel now, here we are, some decades later from your writing, that some of this stuff has come true and some of it hasn't? I mean, obviously, there's one that hasn't maybe so much.
I had an interesting experience just a couple of weeks ago. I visited a laboratory scanning the structure of the brain in very much the same way that I imagined when I wrote a science fiction book around 1990, which was The Silicon Man.
Right.
And I never thought I would live long to see that, but it's happening.
It's pretty exciting. We've had a number of people on this show, in fact, the last few weeks, talking a little bit about, these things. Some poo-poo it, some say even if you could do it, it'd be a bad idea, but I think most of us who watch, because we're all science fiction fans, go, yeah, I'm ready. I'll take my brain, please. You knew Philip K. Dick. You were saying just a few years before his death. You've interviewed all the greats. I mean, Frank Herbert and Isaac Asimov and Ray Bradbury and Kurt Vonnegut. That, to me, as a science fiction fan, that would be so exciting, so fascinating.
One of the great things about the science fiction field is that you can be just an avid reader and still be accepted as an equal by the people in the field who you revere, which is a very unusual experience. The first time I met a writer named Alfred Bester, he had written the book that seemed most profoundly important to me, and he invited me to his apartment, and we were just chatting, and it was a wonderful experience. And I thought, well, I wonder if I could write a book of profiles of the other science fiction writers who I admire, who are all getting on in years, and this is the best possible time. It's the peak of their careers. And those books I wrote were called Dreammakers and Dreammakers Volume 2. And actually, one of them was just republished by a small press.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. Yeah, they've been out of print for a while. So I'm very glad to hear that. Because I feel sometimes the same way when we're doing this, when we're talking to the innovators and inventors and creators of technology, some of them the earliest inventors, like Douglas Engelbart, and we just recently spent some time with Vint Cerf, that it's great to get these guys on record and to talk to them about their inventions while they're at their peak. I guess that's why writing for Wired must have been a lot of fun.
Well, writing for Wired was very special because the formula that I followed was find a small group of people who no one else has written about who are doing something special. And it was surprising how many times you could stumble upon this because most journalists don't have the time to do the stumbling, to do the looking around and digging things up. Most often the journalist is given an instruction by an editor, go and run a feature on Microsoft. And I had the great fortune to be able to discover people, for instance, who were racing electric-powered cars, and this was 20 years before Tesla.
Wow.
So it was a time when all sorts of things were popping out of the woodwork, and some of them were never heard from again, like the company that was had a machine that would produce smells while you were visiting websites.
I remember that article.
one of the all-time biggest disasters in startup history. But it worked. That was the funny thing.
It worked. Nobody really wanted it.
Nobody really wanted it. I sort of wanted it, but only sort of.
It's a sense. It's an important sense. Mm-hmm. I think that tech journalism has changed so much since the early days of Wired magazine. And now it's really all about how fast you can come up with a scoop, how you can beat the other guy to the story, whether it's true or not. Write it fast. Even if it's wrong, you can correct it later. That's changed really everything. And when I talk to people like you and Stephen Levy and the people who I respect so much who wrote, Stephen calls himself an author of slow writing, who really took their time and really discovered new stuff. I feel that we've lost in some ways something that was really important to journalism, to tech journalism.
Well, there's not quite as much money in it as there used to
Maybe
be.
Maybe that's the problem. Yeah.
Wired could afford to pay me
right.
To spend 6 weeks on a story.
Right.
I don't know how much that happens anymore.
Do you still teach? I know you taught for a long time.
No, I don't have a regular enough schedule to teach.
Ah.
So I just have to write educational books as a substitute.
Lots more to come with Charles Platt, our interview on triangulation. Recorded at an earlier date, but I'm glad you could see it today. Our show brought to you by LegalZoom.com. I don't have to tell you that, well, maybe I do. If you're an entrepreneur and you're ready to start your business, there are certain things you really ought to do. A DBA, of course, trademark your brands or your service marks, your logo. And I think most important, and Kevin Rose told me this, you need to incorporate. Now, you could do a Chapter S or C or an LLC, but I know all of those things are daunting. They're overwhelming, and you're probably thinking very expensive to go to a lawyer to do all this. The good news is, in every respect, those things are easy to do if you know what you're doing, and that's where LegalZoom comes in. They're not a law firm. They provide legal services at your direction. It's basically a self-help place. And this is what I did when I started Twit in 2005. It was just me. I said, I'm an LLC. And we filled out the forms. It starts at $99 plus state filing fees. It's so affordable. And in fact, we're still running the company on the LLC that I created back in 2005 for $99. But that's not all. We trademarked the Twit logo. We trademarked the Twit name. Of course, you got to have that protection. You might have other business needs. You might want to do a chapter. You could do it all. Visit LegalZoom.com right now and check it out. They've added something I love. They have the legal plan attorneys now. They've pre-negotiated low-cost, flat-rate plans with an attorney in your state. You can go to the legal plan and read their profiles, unedited reviews from existing customers, and then set it up. So if you have a question like, well, is chapter S or C, what's the difference, for instance? You can go there and ask those questions, and it really is helpful and very, very affordable. LegalZoom.com. If you use the offer code triangulation, you could take $10 off at checkout. It's not going to make you rich, but I tell you what, it's better than a slap in the face, and it lets them know you heard it on triangulation, and that's important for us. So LegalZoom.com. Check it out. I know you want to start a business. Or maybe do a will for your family. They do things like a pet protection agreement. So if you pass away, who takes your dog or cat? You need that. LegalZoom.com. Take $10 off when you use the offer code triangulation. And good luck with your new business. I think that's great. All right, back we go to Charles Platt and his books on electronics projects as we continue with triangulation. What keeps you busy these days?
I love exploring Arizona backroads because Arizona is about as close to the surface of Mars as you're going to get in the look and feel.
Yeah.
And also quite hostile to human life. You have to be a little careful out there. So if I can't explore space, I can always explore Arizona.
Sometimes when I look at those pictures, those beautiful pictures we're getting back from the Mars rover, It mm-hmm. really does feel like, oh, I know that landscape. It's New Mexico. I've been there. Yeah. It's amazing to see pictures like that as if they're post. I mean, they're really, you're there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the grainy black and white images of the moon that we got. They're real high quality images. Panoramas,
and of course,
even.
When I was growing up, no one imagined that these would be done by autonomous or remote-controlled machines, because machines weren't reliable enough in those days.
Right.
So it was just assumed you were going to have a guy there with a camera. So the idea that this thing can go into the right orbit around Mars and land on some inflated balloons and bounce, and then the balloons deflate and the thing rolls up. Now, that's really implausible by 1960 standards.
If you had written that, people would say, "Oh, come on, that's not."
It would have stretched our credulity.
That bouncing—it's amazing! It's amazing. I just loved that. And then the other one—they never tested it, where they just lowered it down on wires to within inches of.
Right.
They'd never even tested it. It's like, well, it should work, and it did.
Yeah, I was amazed.
It did. It seems to me that's a very interesting and fertile field right now, is autonomous, whatever, autonomous vehicles, particularly, you know, self-driving cars. I would think that if you were writing for Wired, that would be a subject that would be of great interest right now.
I don't really know what the principle is for Wired these days, but as I say, in the past, we would have had to find a small group of crazy people who had a new idea.
You'll find them. They're there. They're absolutely...
Well, robots were always popular. I mean, at the Maker Faire, there were robots all over the place.
It must be very exciting for you to go to the Maker Faire and see what an incredible creative ferment Make Magazine has created.
Yes, it is. And it's even more exciting to meet someone who's read one of my books and has actually decided to do something as a result. I met this 11-year-old boy who was very, very serious. And he said, "I built a candy vending machine using the principles in your book."
Oh, that's awesome.
And he had it there at the fair. It was all made out of cardboard, but it was wonderful.
Oh,
and it worked,
awesome.
You know? It had some little coin return mechanism inside of it. His name was Riley. So I had a great time talking to Riley.
It's neat to see the kids there at these Maker Faires, and they're so excited by what's going on.
Riley was there leading his mother around, who just had this helpless look.
I bet. When you have a Riley in your life, just go with it. Get him the books.
Yeah, you have to.
Just get him the books. The good news is this all is out there, and there's lots of mentoring. There's hacker spaces now. There's lots of maker spaces, lots of places that you can get help, even if you're not the person who has the faintest clue about what's going on here.
Right.
It makes me wish I had more time to kind of get in a workshop and tinker and build things. It looks like so much fun.
Well, I try to include things which are relatively simple and can be done like in a couple of hours. And then there are other things that you really have to allocate a couple of days. Yeah. So you take your choice.
This is great. I mean, you've got the 9 things people do wrong most often when they're soldering, or the 4 most common perf boarding errors and things like that. This is the kind of stuff that will save you days of mistakes. And the fact that this exists is so great. It's a boon to anybody who wants to get into creating electronics. I think it's wonderful.
It's what I wish I had had when I was a teenager and I was trying to figure this stuff out for myself. And it would have saved me a lot of time.
Yeah. The newest is Make More Electronics, Journey Deep into the World of Logic, Chips, Amplifiers, Sensors, and Randomicity. What is that? Are you making random number generators?
I like to build games. And one thing you need in a game is for things to happen unexpectedly. And if you have a complicated series of numbers, that can seem unexpected or random to the human perceptions. So is it really random or is it just complicated? And I go into that issue at some length, and I finally end up with this thing called a linear feedback shift register, which is actually very simple to build. You only need 4 chips. And that creates a stream of numbers, which actually the same principle is used for people who are in the field of encryption. So from something relatively simple like I want a random opponent in a game, you get into something that's actually quite complicated, which is how can I encrypt a message in a way which no one anywhere can decipher.
So this is not a pseudo random number generator.
It is pseudo random because you really need a Geiger counter to get a truly random. But it's so complicated as a stream of numbers that it seems random.
It's sufficiently random, or sufficiently pseudo random.
Yeah.
Do you actually build a game? Any kind of game in the book?
Many
fun.
Games. Yeah.
Well, I'm mad.
Because I enjoy playing games, so I figure, what the hell?
I'm going to have to get Dale. He didn't send us the third. I guess it hadn't come out when he sent us these two.
I think that was the problem.
Yeah.
We got some advanced copies at Maker Faire, but I actually don't own a copy of the Make More Electronics yet, but it's on the way.
Well, it's available now from Amazon.com, $25. Amazon Prime will get you the book by Wednesday. And or Tuesday, or depending on when you order it. I guess it could be Friday if you don't order it too soon. Charles, I want to thank you for your time. The book, brand new one, is More Electronics, but you've got to also have Make Electronics, so you got the complete set. And as long as you're – is there a volume 2 of the Electronic Components book yet?
I wish there was. I took time off from writing volume 2 to do the Make More Electronics, but volume 2 is on the way.
We got to get you real back soon. To work. Volume 2 will have integrated circuits, light and sound sources, and then you got to go to volume 3, which is sensing devices. And by then we'll be able to build a robot, I think.
Well, the idea is that the encyclopedia volumes are purely for reference.
Right.
They don't take you step by step through anything. It's just if you forget something, you can look it up very quickly in the encyclopedia.
And if you go, gosh, how could I do this, you can look it up and say, oh, that's what I need, an unregulated power supply.
You can look up something which you think you need, and then the very next entry will tell you what you really do need because it's all organized by subject.
I love it. And maybe your Radio Shack will have what you need, but you have the details in here. There are a number of very good places you can go to.
There are many ways to get what you need. You can also order direct from Hong Kong, which I often do.
Do you really?
Yeah.
You get those big bags of resistors?
Especially the bags of resistors. Sometimes from Thailand, you know. They come through. Two weeks later, you get them in the mail.
You have to hand sort them out?
No, they're all labeled.
Oh, they're all labeled? Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
Charles, so nice to talk to you. Thank you for the books. Every time I talk to somebody at Make, I go, I got to do this. It's just it's such a great group of people. And I think in many ways, Make is the Wired for the 21st century. It's taking it to the next step. You do it yourself now. We'll see you at the next Maker Faire. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Charles Platt, the book, once again, Make More Electronics, but maybe get, I think Amazon will probably, you could put the two together and you'll have them all. We do triangulation. Normally we do it on Mondays. We did this one a little bit ahead of time so that we could get Charles on and have it ready for you. But Mondays, 11 a.m. Pacific, tune in. You can see it live. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. It's helpful if you do because your questions in the chat room are always of value to me. But if you can't, we make on-demand versions of the show available, audio and video, after the fact at twit.tv/TRI. All of our 150-plus episodes are there. And, of course, you can always subscribe using iTunes or get one of the Twit apps for your device and get it automatically streamed to you, so that way you always have a copy of Triangulation to watch no matter where you are. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.